Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And as I promised, we're really going to be focused on covering ground with the content. As a matter of fact, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
So this is the first content show I've had since my P-Day last week, and I've kind of laid it out. So just so you know, I'm committed to doing this year's content. I want to finish the curriculum, and I want to get through as much possible content that we can, because, folks, if you really think about this radio show, if you really think about these recordings, this is almost like an audiobook that you just have to deal with my editorializing and, you know, my obnoxiousness or my arrogance, what have you. So forgive me. I don't try to be arrogant, but I guess, you know, when you're standing on top of the hill, the right hill, you know, the winning hill, then you get a little arrogant, I guess. And it's a personality flaw, because I love being right. I mean, I who doesn't want to win the argument? Nobody goes into an argument saying, I want to lose an argument today. Nobody, believe me.
And being right would be everybody's personality flaw.
I think so, but I learned very young how good it felt when I was in second grade or third grade when I had an argument with my father about a mathematical formula that, you know, I said, well, this is how you do that. And he goes, no, that's not how you do it. And then he tried to, you know, explain to me how to do it. And he goes, you know what? You're right. That's how you do it. And boy, I felt so good. It felt so good when I heard my father say, you're right. At a young age, you know, I go, wow, I like being right. And so it was one of the things that, you know, kind of kept my head on straight in many ways, because I was definitely in the wrong places at the wrong time too many times in my life. So, I'm a person. I'm hard-headed. I make my mistakes, but I eventually, as I got wiser, I said, well, I'll just stick to being right. Anyway, so we are going to dive into this. I just need to go through the obligatories. That debt is fraud. It's now or never. And we want you to, you know, make sure if you have any affinity, you have any attachment to appealing to heaven, to pray, please, please continue. But when you get up off your knees, when you open your eyes and lift your head at the end of your prayer, take the world on, because the Lord will bless you in your endeavors for liberty. He always has. He's always blessed people throughout the annals of history. We've been blessed when we stood on liberty. It's just that he's not in business of saving countries. He gave us this country and this constitution, and if we're going to save it, it is on your shoulders. It's on our heads, and the blood is on our hands if we're going to do this. If we don't do it, the blood is on our hands. Bottom line. So, as we look at where we are and what we're doing, please appeal to heaven and get engaged, get involved. You need to start working in your county. Go through the five critical documents. Start creating meetings. We will help you. We will give you, we will make you look great. Because when you're right, everybody loves you, right? Just be careful not to make those, you know, statements of, you know, things you don't know. But don't talk about things you don't know until you know. Right? I mean, I remember in the intelligence training, whenever you brief somebody and you get a question you can't answer, you need to respond in the way of saying, I don't know, but I will go find out. And that's how you respond. And so when I was briefing, officers, colonels, commanders, generals, even dignitaries when I was in the Pentagon, there were points in time where I might have been given, and I know with a colonel, I was given a question, and I even with the general, but actually when I was questioned with the general, I knew and I was responding because the general was wrong. As a matter of fact, I'll go on record. It was Anthony Zinni. General Zinni was wrong, but he said he didn't care. He said, I don't care if we have to slug it out and how much lives we're going to lose because they're in the same environment and I think we have a superior force. Okay. But bottom line, what we were talking about and everything else, because I don't want to get into the details of that because it was kind of classified. But bottom line, if I know what I'm talking about, I will stand up and say, I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I'm here to help folks. Now, moving into the very last thing, just to kind of tie it all together, you need to start your campaign, and your campaign needs to be on the truth. Your campaign needs to be on the five critical documents, the resolutions, and all of the documents that come after that. So we're here to help. You can start doing petitions, but you need to get people in your area that are actually equally educated so they understand why you're doing this. If people don't understand what the expectations are, then 9 times out of 10, they're going to lose interest or they won't even get involved. They have to know up front that this is the only way we're going to take this country back, and it has to be a movement. We, the people, have to do it. This country cannot be saved by Trump. It cannot be saved by GR. It cannot be saved by 20 GRs. It can't be saved by 1,000 GRs. It needs the people to stand up and say, we're supporting the Constitution now. I don't care if, you know, welfare is going to go away and I'm on welfare. I'm going to have to provide for myself. And I know we have lots of people out there. And as a matter of fact, we have the way to taking care of that because welfare doesn't go away. America is the most generous nation in the world. We used to be even more generous than we are today because we actually took care of the infirm. We took care of the elderly. We actually loved our families. We can get back to that. We can create communities that take care of each other. That's what we have to do. We should never have gotten to the federal government should never have gotten into the business of controlling all of this. You would do far better if you started living, you know, a good, righteous life and living in the land of liberty under the Constitution than allowing them to continually steal our government and driving it off the cliff. So I'm done. I'm off the soapbox. We're going through James Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. We left off with Friday, July 6th, even though it's not July, it's March. But we left off Friday, July 6th, 1787. And we were talking about a few different topics. And the topics that they cover in this part of the convention is that important that we're kind of going to suffer through this because they kind of started talking a little bit about slavery and representation, and they also talked about admission of states into the Union. And so as we go through this, then we actually are going to go through the rest of this on July 6th, and we will continue going through this for at least a couple of pages. So folks, download the document and read along because it's kind of highlighted for you. And please read along with us, okay? Now, we're on Mr. Gorham on July 6th. He's the third person speaking. And this is right after they kind of made this motion, or actually Wilson seconded the motion, but with the view of leaving the committee under no implied shackles. So that's where we left off, okay? You good with me?
All right.
Yep. All right, so great. So go ahead and pick up with Mr. Gorham and on.
Okay.
And of course, I'm going to interrupt you if there's something I want to go down a rat hole on, but you're going to keep me out of the rat hole because we really need to get through this stuff, okay? Thank you so much.
I'll try.
All right.
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Mr. Gorham apprehended great inconveniency from fixing directly the number of representatives to be allowed to each state. He thought the number of inhabitants the true guide, though perhaps some departure might be expedient from the full proportion. The state also would vary in their relative extent by separations of parts of the largest states. A part of Virginia is now on the point of separation. In the province in the province of Maine, a convention at this time deliberating on a separation from Massachusetts. Is that what that stands for?
That is correct. So let me kind of expound on this. So Virginia is already looking at creating a state that would be a part of Virginia. The way the before the Constitution, the states and their territories were just going to grow. In other words, if you saw the projection of the United States under the Articles of Confederation, Virginia would extend from the Atlantic all the way across the United States to the Pacific Ocean. Underneath that would be a stripe called North Carolina that would go from the Atlantic to the Pacific. South Carolina is the same. And above that, some of the states would do that. I believe Pennsylvania was one of those states that kind of married up to the top of Virginia. And when you look at, I think, Massachusetts, Maine was a part of that. Only Maine, because Vermont was a part of New Hampshire. Because, however, the Massachusetts, Maine territories, colonies, and so forth, how they divided it, they created these lanes or these boundaries. And so due to the fact that how they laid it all out, there were these states that were getting ready to join the Union. Now, Maine was already, they were already talking about Maine. When did Maine join the Union? Do you know? This is why this is important.
No.
Maine didn't join the Union because when Congress formed, they said, we need to have so many inhabitants living in that state before we can make it a state. Even though Maine wanted to become a state, why is that? Because at least Congress at that point in time had their heads screwed on, right? And they had this paradigm that a state needed to sustain itself. If it was going to join the Union, it needed to sustain itself.
Right.
So they figured it needed, and I think they arbitrarily came up with a number, but they ended up settling on 60,000. And so when Wyoming joined, they almost made it to 60,000, and they said, well, we're close enough, we want to join, and they just joined. It's a colorful history with Wyoming, but nevertheless, the point is that they at least had these bars to make sure that the state would have enough inhabitants to be able to fund the state government. Now, you got to remember that the state government, they may have created a capital, and that was a costly endeavor that the people had to pay for. But once they did that, what else did the state do in their lives other than basically, create taxes on the businesses and so forth? I mean, maybe a sales tax or what have you, but they weren't involved in your everyday life unless you were an established business, like a general store. Every family was a business. Every family either was a rancher, they were growing food, there was a cobbler. Everybody had to figure out how to be able to sell some goods to somebody else if you wanted to get anything else or you had to be self-sufficient. You had to create your own steelworks to make your own nails, to build buildings. And when you look at George Washington and his plantation, he manufactured everything for himself. Rope, nails, all of that. So when people really look, they don't understand that these men were that wise. We weren't buying everything from Europe. Washington was one of the most affluent people. I'm sorry, I've been in the rat hole for a long time, so I need to get out of this. But bottom line, even Thomas Jefferson was a very thrifty person in trying to create his own, so he'd be self-sufficient. The more self-sufficient you are, the more you're maintaining, control over your riches, your wealth, and so forth. So bottom line. We see Maine coming in off of Massachusetts, but it didn't come in until 1820, and it came in as a part of the slave trade. And I think that they may have made an exception with Maine because Maine has always been sparsely populated. And so you got to remember that they started violating the Constitution. So the federal government may have actually been giving welfare to the state of Maine throughout time here and time there because it became a state in the Union. Not that they had the authority to do that, and I have no profound, or I can't even say that for a fact, but I do know that if you can barely sustain yourself, and then, you're really not a state. But over time, the federal government came in, and I think some of the welfare that they got was the fact that they were buying up forests and other things from them, what they had no authority to do. That all happened after 1849, though. But anyway, back to this. This whole point was that they were talking about the mechanism of bringing states into the Union. And so, go ahead. They're talking about having fixed representation. And this also, they haven't even spoke of the need of maintaining a lesser sovereignty to the new states joining the Union that wouldn't be on the coastline. So go ahead, because we already covered that already, but go ahead.
Okay. In such events, the number of representatives ought certainly to be reduced. He hoped to see all the states made small by proper divisions, but instead of their becoming formidable, as was apprehended, to the small states, he conceived that let the general government be modified as it might, there would be a constant tendency in the state governments to encroach upon it. It was of importance, therefore, that the extent of the states should be reduced as much and as fast as possible. The stronger the government shall be made in the first instance, the more easily will these divisions be effected, as it will be of less consequence in the opinion of the states, whether they be of great or small extent.
You see how they're justifying reducing the sovereignty and basically creating a disadvantage for all the states joining the Union eastward, or westward, I mean, right? By reducing their sovereignty. And so what they're trying to do is to create a caste system or a class system between the original states are important, the coastal states are important, you middle states are just, they're already creating the flyover states. Anyway. Okay, let's go with Mr. Gary of Massachusetts.
Mr. Gary did not think with his colleague that the large states ought to be cut up. This policy has been incalculated by the middling and smaller states, ungenerously and contrary to the spirit of the Confederation. Ambitious men will be apt to solicit needless divisions till the states be reduced to the size of counties. If this policy should still actuate the small states, large ones could not confederate safely with them, but right, would be obliged to consult their safety by confederating only with one another. He favored the commitment and thought that representation ought to be in the combined ratio of numbers of inhabitants and of wealth, and not of either singly.
Okay, so this is interesting. They're all talking about how they want to create these disadvantages. And the word inculcated means educated or brainwashed. They've all got this in their head by the middling and or the central states and the smaller states, right? So when you look at Delaware, Delaware was a small state. But Delaware wanted to maintain its equal sovereignty, where the other small states, they wanted to make these other states in the center more of counties and not necessarily states. If you see what they're doing, everybody would have been very well aware of, hey, look at Maryland, Delaware, and, you know, Connecticut and Vermont, New Hampshire. Hold on here. Why do they have that representation than us? Because it was already brought up that these states were already ready to come in. Are you going to tell these states, Kentucky and Maine, and again, Vermont was actually the first state in the Union, then Kentucky, then Tennessee, and Maine didn't make it until 1820. So can you imagine the conversation that they would have had to have if they actually put it into the Constitution that we would not have this Constitution today had states not had the privilege and the benefit of having full sovereignty like every state in the Union, having equal footing. So when new states started joining the Union and the concept of equal footing was the design of the Constitution, it wasn't until 1816 where the federal government actually started diminishing the sovereignty of the states. I ask anybody to examine the Enabling Act of Ohio and the Enabling Act of Indiana, and you will clearly see that Indiana had disadvantages when it joined the Union. Not great disadvantage, not like the West, But it already started stepping over the federal government, Congress, was already stepping over the line regarding that Republican form of government and it becoming a state or basically a part of the union, an equal sovereign, an equal part of the union. The courts don't even recognize the sovereignty of the states anymore. At least the Supreme Court doesn't. So, yeah. Okay. So let's get back, because we're still talking about the admission of states into the union. So let's see what Rufus King has to say out of Massachusetts.
Okay, Mr. King wished the clause to be committed chiefly in order to detach it from the report with which it had no connection. He thought also that the ratio of representation proposed could not be safely fixed, since in a century and a half, our computed increase of population would carry the number of representatives to an enormous excess. That year number of inhabitants was not the proper index of ability and wealth, that property was the primary object of society, and that in fixing a ratio, this ought not to be excluded from the estimate. With regard to new states, he observed that there was something peculiar in the business which had not been noticed. The U.S. were now admitted to be proprietors of the county northwest of Ohio, of the Ohio. Congress, by one of their ordinances, have implicitly laid it out into 10 states and have made it a fundamental article of compact with those who may become settlers, that as soon as the number in any one state shall equal that of the smallest of the 13 original states, it may claim admission into the Union. Delaware does not contain it. It is computed more than 35,000 souls, and for obvious reasons will not increase much for a considerable time. It is possible, then, that if this plan be persisted in by Congress, 10 new votes may be added, without a greater addition of inhabitants than are represented by a single vote of Pennsylvania.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The plan, as it respects one of the new states, is already irrevocable. The sale of the lands having commenced, and the purchasers and settlers will immediately become entitled to all the privileges of the compact.
Okay, so now we see that Mr. King has identified a snare in their plan, that the Northwest Ordinance was actually going to, you know, it, the way it was designed was going to create a problem. And they created a compact. He even pointed that out, that they're working on a compact with the people that live in that area. That's one of the reasons why the Constitution, when it came into full force, basically superseded all additional governing and admitting new states into the Union. If it's in the Constitution, it supersedes, which is why Ohio was brought into the Union without the standards of the Northwest Territory. This is why I tell people you need to read those two enabling acts, because Congress then used, you know what? We kind of have had, you know, our butter, you know, pretty well applied to one side of the piece of bread, and we're letting these new states into the Union. However, here's the problem. We're not obtaining an advantage when we could. We could actually reach back and say we want to apply the Northwest Ordinance, and then by doing so, we can create reservations and disadvantages to Indiana. Instead of bringing them in as a full sovereign state, we're going to take resources away from them. Some of their land and some of their salt mines, we're not going to allow them to sell or to really harvest their potential. In so doing, this is when Congress and the federal government overstepped its bounds in admitting new states into the Union. But I'm showing you how these guys were talking and devising, they were rubbing their grubby mitts and trying to devise a plan that would have created an advantage for themselves. Now, we're going into break. So with that, I basically will say this, that as we go through the Constitutional Convention, calmer heads and more logic and reason prevailed, because these men started realizing, why cast into stone, or why create the die to, and have the die cast, that we had to have another civil war or a revolutionary war? We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so hopefully this is starting to make real sense why this is so important. Because as they migrated through this, they came to and they wrote the language of Article 4, Section 3, to not give, there was no delegated authority to Congress or to the federal government to be able to diminish any state coming into the Union, or the language would have been there. Does that make sense, Tammy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
In other words, they would have said, you know, because everything had to be very specific. And so it only said that new states could be admitted into the Union. It also said there are some reservations that a state can't be split up from a known state, because they started talking about this. They wanted to make sure that, because factions started to divide, that that wouldn't be necessarily an easy way to break away a state. The only way you could do that is with the permission of the state legislature. So in other words, if you had a minor faction like West Virginia wanted to split away from Virginia because they weren't slave. You know, if you look at the, it was coal mines, and actually, I don't even think they started really, you know, getting into the coal mines until the Civil War. But they wanted to break away from Virginia because they weren't, you know, in slavery, and they didn't agree with it. So the Civil War became the great opportunity when Virginia left the Union. They said, we want to stay in the Union. We'd like to be admitted as West Virginia. Now, because Virginia seceded, West Virginia could actually then secede from them and say, we want to become a state. And the state, the Constitution allows new states to join. But if that state isn't in the Union, like Virginia, does you see my point? Most people have a real problem with what West Virginia did, but West Virginia was brilliant. The problem was that Lincoln said that they couldn't leave the Union, that they had to still be in the Union. But, nothing Lincoln did made sense. And when you really look through the whole logic of all of this, I'm going, it only spells out what a tyrant he is and how he violated the Constitution. Because West Virginia never would have been admitted as a state in the Union if Virginia was still in the Union. But when they actually pack up and they walk out of Congress and say, we're no longer a part of this representation or union, that means that they've left. And when Lincoln says they can't leave, but clearly they did, and we've already covered documents where states can walk away from any compact. This is a fundamental tenet of contract law. When one line, when one part of the Constitution is being violated, a state is more than free to walk away. However, Madison said that, you know, the way contract law is, that the reason that they're breaking the contract, one, has to be willful, and there's another word for it. It starts with an M. But it's right there in the report, in Madison's report on the Constitutional Convention, that for a state to secede, the act had to be with malice. So, in other words, willful and with malice. In other words, the union, or I should say the government, or these other states were willfully and with malice trying to hurt the southern states, and they actually were. They were willfully and with malice violating the Constitution by creating economic warfare. Make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So anybody that wants to argue whether they could leave or not or whatever, it's done. It's moot. They could. The Constitution allowed any state, if for the purpose of a violation to the Constitution, any state can leave. We don't want Wyoming. We don't want these states to leave, because if they leave, we can't save the Union. When you have a parent walk out of a marriage, you can't save the family.
Yeah.
Okay. And when you have enough parents out of this 50-parent family with one kid, you know, you have enough of the parents walk out, and the rest of the parents, or the prevailing number of parents, are bad parents that want to continue violating the Constitution. This is how it all gets destroyed. So leaving the Union is not a way of fixing the problem. But this is why Madison expounded upon ultra interposition in 1834. That when a state is being actually attacked independently, not as a part of the law, but the federal government is taking land or doing acts independently to that state, they have not just a right, but an obligation of preservation of their sovereignty and existence to actually defend themselves. Right? You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
So there we go. So this is the conversation that we need to start having, so that Bob and many of the legislators start understanding these things.
Yeah.
This makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because now they're going to start, what does this ultra interposition mean? That means that Yellowstone and all this BLM land that they're taking, even if they're paying for it, they're committing fraud. They don't have the authority to pay for it. So do the people have to pay that money back? No. They've assumed an authority that they can do it, and they're throwing money around. And bottom line, it's all fraudulent, it's a usurpation, and they should be spanked for that. But there's not money that they have a right or entitled to get back. In other words, when an entity has committed fraud, nobody gets anything back. Everybody has basically gone,
everybody
huh.
Everybody loses.
That everybody loses when we allow fraud to occur, right? Well, except for those few people that walked away from the property. But guess who wins? The state. Because the people that sold that land and walked away and gave it to BLM, the state gets that. Those people they keep their money, but they don't get that land back. They don't become a win-win. They just, okay, that's all I got. And the state actually then has to, you know, have an opportunity of selling some land. And that means that they make the proceeds off the sale. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So now I think we're on with Mr. Butler. Let's see what Mr. Butler wants to bring to the table here.
Mr. Butler agreed to the commitment of the committee. Were to be left at liberty. Were to be left at liberty. He was persuaded that the more of the subject was examined, the less it would appear that the number of inhabitants would be a proper rule of proportion. If there were no other objection, the changeableness of the standard would be sufficient. He concurred with those who thought some balance was necessary between the old and new states. He contended strenuously that property was the only just measure of representation. This was the great object of government, the great cause of war, the great means of carrying it on.
So you're going to notice that there's this little common knowledge, but I think there's a big difference between a Southerner saying property and a Northerner saying property, because the Southerners considered their slaves property. The Northerners would never say, never consider their employees working in their companies and factories and what have you as property.
Yeah.
Okay. So I, from now on, am going to use the word changeableness.
Yeah. That was a new word. Changeableness.
Well, obviously it was a proper word back then. Anyway. Okay. So Mr. Pinckney of South Carolina, let's see what he says.
Mr. Pinckney saw no good reason for committing. The value of land had been found on full investigation to be an impracticable rule. contributions of revenue, including imports and exports, must be too changeable in their amount, too different to be adjusted, and too injurious to the non-commercial states. The number of inhabitants appeared to him the only just and practicable rule. He thought the blacks ought to stand on any inequality with whites, but would agree to the ratio settled by Congress. He contended that Congress had no right under the Articles of Confederation to authorize the admission of new states, no such case having been provided for.
Ah, so we're peeling it back a little bit. Now we're starting to see the slavery was just thrown on the table, as well as, you know, the ineptness of the Articles of Confederation, which is one of the reasons why the United States was creating a compact with the Northwest Territory. Now, I believe that the more hard up the United States became in trying to get more, you know, land and property to join the Union, to make these things states, really was incumbent on whether they would be willing to give them a deal or not. In other words, if they weren't going to make these states equal, then they would have to force states into the Union. In other words, they would have to go down the path of becoming a king and exercising authority upon all others except for those that are already in. Am I making sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they would actually, because any land west of the Mississippi, why would they want to even adjoin to this concocted idea that they would even be lesser of value to them?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I don't care if you own us or not. We're fighting you to see if you can make us come in. And that it would have only just been headaches for them going down this path. Like I said, calmer and cooler heads started prevailing when they started. But they actually was going down these paths of concocting these advantages. And so as Mr. Pinckney starts talking about this, he was basically laying out that they've already gone down the path of, you know, trying to figure out how to use property as a true value. Because property is not the same in one state as it is in another. Even though at that point in time there may have been a little bit more of an equal, we can see today that if we were taxing a state based on the value of its property, many of the flyover states would not be paying hardly anything in their dues to the Union. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because the land, if you look at what a house sells for in Iowa, many of these states that are, you know, people aren't moving there. In other words, supply and demand drives the cost of things, right? And if everybody's leaving California, the only reason why California still has a high cost of living and a high property value is because they have illegals that they're taking the property off of the market when it gets abandoned or sold or what have you. And they're granting that. They're creating socialized living for all of the illegals. So in other words, they have this insatiable desire and need for housing in California. If they didn't have the illegals there, they would have a glut of property. And they know this. And the real estate agencies know this. And the builders know this, which is why they don't want to see this invasion stop. Who benefits? Property holders. In other words, you know, everybody's property in the United States, here's the consequence. When we repel the invaders, folks, our property value is going to go down dramatically because the demand for property will go down dramatically. We're going to remove, what, 100,000 or four? Not 100. We're talking millions. And so we're probably looking at 50 million people kicked out, repelled.
Wow.
And that's a lot. And it'll hurt every state, and the states that have the highest concentration, Illinois, California, New York, where these illegals are landing. And, you know, it's smart for these red states to actually get them out of there Because they're not being caught up in this real estate scam. So what's going to happen? So most people think what Trump is doing is he's with Bitcoin and everything else, that the property is actually going to go down. Trump cannot afford to allow that to happen. So he can't kick the illegals out. He's going to kick out bad guys, but he's not going to enforce the Constitution. These are rat holes I'm going down, but these are sound rat holes that I'm trying to put on the table so people can start seeing that even though your life is going to get better, it's not going to get right. Because down the road, and Catherine Austin Fitz has already talked about how the value of property will actually all of a sudden plummet. And when that happens, when people lose their property, they're just going to sell, you know, property, you know, for pennies on the dollar. And the globalists, the people that actually have this great leverage in the digital currency, unconstitutionally, because there'll be foreigners and everybody else buying up American property. That is unconstitutional. Not one foreign entity, no state, the federal government can't even allow it to happen. But no state can allow a foreigner to buy a foreign entity, whether they're a person, a country, it doesn't matter. You cannot buy and hold any state land, period. Yeah. So bottom line, when we can get this all back and we'll actually, this is the only way we're going to save our property value, the only way we'll save ourselves. There is going to be a level of austerity. But I'm telling you, we're far better off with dealing with and getting rid of the unconstitutional government than allowing this to persist. We'll get our property back, but there will be, I mean, there's always consequences when you make changes, but these consequences will lead us to a level of prosperity Americans today can't even fathom. Where energy will become so cheap that we will be able to have subscriptions to energy. In other words, you won't pay by the kilowatt, you'll just pay for a monthly service. We can do these things, folks, but it'll take a little while to get there. It's just like, why are eggs still high? Because we have to recover from the Biden culling of cows and eggs and so forth, or chickens. So the cost of beef, the cost of chickens, the cost of eggs, all of these things are going to be outrageously high because he got rid of a whole bunch of them. And we're paying, and the more foreign food we buy, the more we're transferring wealth. It's just like foreign energy. Anything foreign we buy, we're transferring wealth to those nations. We got to stop buying China crap. We got to stop buying any crap from any nation that is out to destroy us. Anyway. I mean, this is just making sense, and people hate it when I make sense. So let's move on, because I think you just finished with Mr. Pickney. So now we're with Mr. Davey in North Carolina. Let's see how he changed. Does he change his sentiments? Let's see what's going on here.
Mr. Davey was for committing the clause in order to get the merits of the question arising on the report. He seemed to think that wealth or property ought to be represented in the second branch and numbers in the first branch.
There you go. Now, that made reason. You know, let's separate them from the first branch being the House and the second branch becoming the Senate. And when you think about it, what ended up happening, the second branch wasn't property, but was the states and the state sovereignty. They shifted everything towards the sovereigns instead of these values and so forth. So there was an emotion. And a motion for committing as made by Governor Morris. Massachusetts, yay. Connecticut, yay. No, no. From New York and New Jersey. Pennsylvania, yay. Delaware, no. So now we had a tie. Maryland was divided, so they couldn't vote. Now a yay, 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 yay. And so the motion carried. And they, you know, went through ballots and so forth. And then Mr. Wilson signified that in his view, in agreeing to the commitment, was that the committee might consider the property of adopting a scale similar to that established in the Constitution of Massachusetts, which would give an advantage to, and I think that may be the smaller states, not year, the smaller states without substantially departing from a rule of proportion. Okay, so that kind of covers this level of debate regarding the admission of new states. Now we're going to jump down, folks, to July 9th, a couple of days later, where they actually talk about admitting new states into the Union. Now, Governor Morris kind of kicks this off, and so he kind of delivers this, and so he basically starts going down this path, and this is where we see, as a precursor, we see that they start setting the representation in the first house to being 40,000 inhabitants. And then he says, the committee to whom was referred the first clause of the first proportion reported to the Grand Committee, beg leave to report, first, that in the first meeting of the legislature, the first branch thereof consists of 56 members, which would then be distributed in this fashion, and they laid out the number based on what they estimated the population to be in fixing representation. Number two is where we talk about admitting new states and the disadvantages or advantages. Let's see what they came up with. So go ahead and let's pick up the admission of new states, number two, from Governor Morris.
But as the present situation of the states may probably alter as well in point of wealth as in the number of their inhabitants, that the legislature be authorized from time to time to augment. What's that stand for?
The number.
Oh, the, okay, to augment the number of representatives, and in case any of the states shall hereafter be divided, or any two or more states united, or any new states created within the limits of the United States, the legislature shall possess authority to regulate the number of representatives in any of the foregoing cases upon the principles of their wealth and number of inhabitants.
So what did that say? I'm going to, instead of telling you, did you garner what that meant? For reading it? Because 9 times out of 10, folks, when you read it, you're more focused on trying to read it right than what you're really reading. Mm-hmm. So it's okay.
Yeah.
But did anything jump out? So when they talk about, or any new state created within the limits of the United States, the legislature shall possess authority to regulate the number of representatives in any of the foregoing cases upon the principles of their wealth and number of inhabitants. Does that make sense? And who are they talking about? How
sense.
So who's the legislature? I guess the real question you have to go is, who is this legislature that shall possess the authority to regulate the number of representatives? In other words, the proposal is that some legislature, what is that legislature?
The 13 states?
It's Congress. So this is the national legislature. They didn't have a name for the House. They remember they talk about the first House and the second House. They didn't come up with a name, Congress, yet. So they were just referring to this national legislature would have the authority to regulate the number of representatives in any of the foregoing cases. So I ask you, in Article 4, Section 3, do you think there's any delegation of authority to establish how representation would be done in these states? And the answer would be a big, quick, loud no, because they would have been able to create disadvantages. So this might be a perfect time to actually pull up the color-coded Constitution. You know, one of my favorite documents, folks, and it's not... I don't produce this and sell this, but this is something that came from the Constitution.org, the Constitution Society, and we've kind of just ran with it and kept it up. So this is what Section 3 of Article 4 says. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of another state, nor any state shall be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as Congress. So does it say anywhere here where Congress will have the power to regulate their representation in the states? Because Representation is established right up here in Article 1, Section 2, and it's right here towards the end where it says, the number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative until such enumeration shall be made. Well, when Congress basically said you have to have 60,000 people, that meant that you were going to get two representatives instead of just one, because they wanted to see a higher population than just 30,000, which is why they said we want two or 60,000 mm-hmm. people in a state before you become a state. So the whole point in reading this is to help you understand what the real language of the Constitution is, because they didn't actually give them the ability to regulate that, because clearly the entitlement is every state of the union is entitled, the people of every state in the union is entitled to one representative for every 30,000. And we also know that in the second house or in the Senate, the state legislature is entitled to equal suffrage. In other words, all states get two senators to vote and represent them in the Senate. The second paragraph of Section 3 in admitting new states says this: the Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules respecting the territory. Now, did that say the Congress has the authority to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the state?
No.
It said territory or other property belonging to the United States. So in other words, when a state actually steps into the union, it becomes a sovereign entity. And technically, it becomes superior to the federal government in all things except the few things delegated in this Constitution. So the last part of this, it says, nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. So in other words, there's nowhere here where the United States can create a claim regarding state and a state's land that would prejudice their claim within their state. In other words, this is our state, this is our claim. You can't make a claim for anything in the state that's not within this Constitution. And as it says here, nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of any particular state. So you start to see that the states were absolutely protected from the federal government being able to come in and possess and take their land from them for any purpose that's not enumerated, which is why the only land that the federal government can constitutionally possess is the seat of government. And I think we can cut that down to nothing, because we now have a virtual world. We are living in a world of real-time governing. We're out of time, and so we can't do any real-time anything now. We have to come back tomorrow, and we'll talk more about what to do and so forth. So, folks, we're giving you the facts. This is why this stuff is so important. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.